This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2.
Most of us know that the world is a different place since 9/11, but Sydney comedian Simon Kennedy lives with that reality every day of his life. Simon's dear mum, Yvonne Kennedy, was enjoying a retirement holiday around Canada and the United States when she boarded American Airlines Flight 77, the flight that crashed into the Pentagon. It was a huge loss for Simon and his brother, but one that he has handled with humour, good grace, and remarkably forgiveness. Simon has recently completed his memoir, 9/11 and the Art of Happiness. Hi, Simon.
Hello, Trina. How are you?
Not too bad. Thanks for coming in.
Pleasure. An absolute pleasure.
Now, the book, I have to say, congratulations. It's a brilliant read.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
It's a really well-crafted book. And it starts with you asleep in your Maroubra house after a night of drinking when you receive a midnight phone call from your brother Lee in London. Now, obviously, in that moment, you had no idea that this was the phone call that was going to change your life forever. But can you tell us a little bit about that moment?
Yeah, no, as you did say, I was a young man in my mid-20s and I had had a couple of sherbets that night, as you want to do, and I'd gone to bed. And if anyone here on that day had gone to bed without looking at the news, they would have been the same. They would have woken up the next day, on the 12th of September, wondering what had happened to the world. But I did get a phone call. And my brother rang me. He said, something's happening in America. There's some planes have hit some buildings. And look, I'm a bit worried about mum. You know, my brother was in London at the time and I had mum's itinerary with me at home. She'd given it to me and I didn't want to get out of bed. But no. I got out of bed and I thought, this is ridiculous. And I grabbed it and I looked at it. And the flight numbers started to match up to what they were saying on the news. And we thought, okay, this is not looking very good at all.
Because you're a natural optimist, so I imagine that you probably resisted even coming to that conclusion for a while.
Yeah. I totally just go, come on, don't jump to conclusions. Mm. You know, what are the odds? Let's not be silly. I wish I was wrong. I really do.
Yeah,
but, and totally. Most of the time I'm right, you know, and it's good to be an optimist. But sometimes luck's not always in your favour.
I can't help thinking, Simon, I don't know if you sort of almost see your life in two parts, you know, maybe life before and after that phone call. It must have been so different.
It is. And you know what? That's a pretty good way of describing it, I guess, because the Simon Kennedy before that phone call, you know, could be as selfish and as carefree as his girlfriend would let him, pretty much. And I got away with a lot. But then this happened and it changed life for all of us. Yeah. You know, my wife, Tani, who was then my girlfriend, you know, she ended up with this slightly dysfunctional, or maybe not just slightly dysfunctional, young man who was trying to pull his head together and work out what was going on. So it really did. It did change things. You know, my worldview changed completely.
We'll talk more about that later, but in those early days, you guys were pretty much on your own trying to find out what happened. Do you remember much about those sort of days immediately after?
Oh, yeah, it was so hazy. Like it was, I remember it, but then it all seems like it was all rolled into one day. So 2 weeks could have easily happened in one day. I spent that many hours sitting in front of a television in my pajamas, hoping for some new information that might, you know, maybe bring us a bit of a relief for some kind of a, I don't know, maybe there was a mistake, all that sort of stuff.
But yeah, did she really get on the plane? What if she hadn't boarded it? Yeah.
And we were as logical as I could be about it. You know, the flight number was the same as what they're reporting, the itinerary, everything was, it matched up, you know, seamlessly. There was no real question. But somewhere in the back of your head, you're going, well, what if, you know, maybe what if she didn't get on the plane? And, I mean, it's not likely. But you can't help but have a bit of hope. And sometimes, I hate to say it, you need to be put out of your misery so you can start to move on. And eventually that we did get that confirmation.
Yeah. Part of the, I guess, the strangeness of what happened to you is that your life then sort of became overtaken by things like dealing with the FBI and then later things like military commissions and, you know, you've met presidents. You almost went to Guantanamo Bay to be part of a military trial. Have you sort of sometimes felt like you're in a movie or you're kind of watching someone else's life?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know who'd play me if it was a movie. Someone.
Well, that could yet happen, Simon.
Someone so. Bald and probably better
Maybe
looking.
Maybe Dan Widdowson.
Dan Widdowson is an old mate of ours, yeah, he'd be perfect. He's better looking than me. That'd be great.
I'd say you're on a path.
Can he act? Really. I don't know.
I think he has done a bit of acting. But,
yeah.
But tell us about the first time the FBI kind of came into your life. That must have been bizarre.
Well, I know it's weird. Like, who gets a knock on the door from the FBI? You know, just me. It's like I used to watch The X-Files, and in my head I pictured this Mulder and Scully rocking up all, you know. It was just this kind of sort of sweet, kind of a slightly awkward guy who looked like an accountant. And
you're like, you can't be FBI. You're not cool.
And it turns out he was, you know, a legal attaché. So he was actually just a lawyer, but, you know, he was a nice guy. But all these people that would come, and it's not meant to happen in your life, these sort of surreal moments. All you're trying to do is process the death of your mother, you know, internally. You know, that's something we're all going to have to face one day if we haven't already. And it's daunting, you know. Your mother's someone so integral to your existence. When you lose it, you have to start, you know, recalculating how things are. And I had to do that. And I had to deal with the FBI, letters from George Bush and emails from, you know, the White House and all this sort of weird stuff that went along with it. So it was a cloudy business. And I'm like, okay, somewhere in here is my life. I've got to find it somewhere.
Yeah, it must have been quite overwhelming, I can only imagine. But you, in the midst of all this stuff that was going on, you also got back into your work very quickly. And as a comedian, you know, making people laugh is kind of a strange choice of profession when you're living under this very dark cloud of grief. So how did that change your comedy, being kind of in the midst of this tragedy?
It took a while for my comedy to change. It didn't leave it too long to get back into it. And as you say, it's a strange choice of career given these circumstances. But there wasn't a choice. You know, it was a career that I'd started before this, and I really started to enjoy it, and I was getting good at it, and I thought, I'm not going to stop, you know.
Almost you couldn't let them ruin that part of your life as well.
No. Yeah. And that whole cliche of, you know, if you don't do this, the terrorists have already won. It was a bit like, my life will go on, you know. You can't stand there and say, well, I guess that's it now. There's no chance for happiness.
Yeah.
You have to, you know, get down, do some hard digging, and you'll start to find it again. And I thought, this is what I do. This is what I've chosen to do. And I enjoyed making people laugh, and I do now. And eventually, it took years for my actual comedy to change. The intentions of my jokes started to, you know, I started to think, you know, I don't want to do jokes that are completely meaningless. You know, I want to make people laugh, and I don't care if it's just a bit of silly, but I want it to be me up there. And I felt very strongly about a lot of things. And one thing I felt strongly about was racism. I can't stand it. I don't think there's a place for it. You know, there's no place for hate. There's no place for exclusion in my worldview. I think it's a nasty business. And I thought, I'm going to lay the boot into the racists, and I'm going to do it through jokes. And people are going to laugh. They might be laughing a bit at themselves, but they might walk away going, yeah, he's right. We are idiots, aren't we, when we do that? and that started to happen, and I found that audiences started to go with me on that one.
It's inevitable, I suppose, as a comedian, though, that there would be moments when people would say insensitive things that would add to your pain. But in your case, it was actually the rhetoric of the Bush government and the war on terror that really offended you most deeply. Why was that so upsetting for you?
Yeah, look, I mean, we were going through, we're going through this time of recovery, trying to deal with, you know, this major event. You know, it's probably one of the biggest peacetime tragedies that anyone had ever seen. And yeah. It was politicized. I mean, it was about 1 year after, it was 1 year after at the 9/11 one-year anniversary where we went to at the Pentagon. And instead of getting a compassionate memorial for victims, what we got was a flag-waving, you know, kind of fist-pumping call to arms, you know, from Bush and Rumsfeld. And I was sitting there thinking, what are they talking about, you know, really? You know, they're talking about going to war, and we'd been hearing these things about Iraq, you know, little bits and pieces about Iraq. And I was offended by it. So I thought, I'm here to remember my mum, and you guys are talking about, a bit of let's go to war, and eventually they marched into Iraq in the name of the victims, in a sense.
Did you feel like you were being used?
Totally used. I thought, yeah. You know what? Don't use my mum's name as a reason to march into Iraq, which had, you know, no real damn connection to this whole thing. And I thought, this is just not okay. And you know, and our government, you know, walked lockstep with that at the time. And so I felt pretty ripped off, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I guess that would have been a real setback to your healing only 1 year afterwards to go and see something that was as, I guess, infuriating as that. But along the way, there must have been also some, I guess, some healing moments, some moments that helped you to kind of take the next step forward. What were some of the sort of key moments of healing on this journey that you've been on now for more than 10 years?
You know, some of those moments, you know, are very hard to pinpoint. Some of it's just day-to-day stuff. And, you know, my wife is a really strong, brave and caring individual. She was the one who stopped me and made me look at myself. And that all came to a head. I guess it was the Bali bombings was one moment, mm-hmm. where I was in Melbourne doing some shows for the Melbourne Fringe Festival, and I was in a hotel room by myself, and I watched the news of this, and it all just brought everything back for me, and it was really difficult to process. I felt like it was happening to me again, you know, and I called Tani at home, and I said, I don't know what's going on. Is this thing happening? It's really, I'm just not dealing with it. And she said, yeah, it's awful. It's awful. And I got angry at her because she didn't fix me right away. And it actually really brought our relationship to a head, where she said, this isn't okay. You need to do something about this. She made me look at myself. And I did. I started to look at myself and started to realize that I wasn't the only one on this journey. And there were people around me that I was either bringing with me or bringing them down. And I had to pep up a bit. And,
wow, that's huge.
Yeah, and she stuck with me. Who knows why?
Yeah, well, but, you know. I've seen you being interviewed on other, you know, TV and heard you on radio and read articles. And people, Simon, always say that the book is a wonderful tribute to your mother, but I actually really felt like it was a tribute to your wife. And she really comes across to me as like a pocket-sized battleship, you know, like she's going out there fighting to get you information about Flight 77, fighting to protect you from the media, like, as you just said, fighting for your relationship. Have you ever wondered how differently you would have dealt with this if you hadn't had her by your side through the whole thing?
Yeah, I got to say that if I was left to my own devices, who knows what would happen to me. I mean, you know, I'm a performer, so I've got some kind of out-of-control ego anyway. That's a given. I mean, you have to just to get up there. So, you know, if that was let to go unchecked, I don't know, you know, where I'd be right now. I don't know, you know, how selfish I might have played things. A lot of people, you know, say some really lovely things on the back of reading my book about me. But to be honest, I'm nothing without that support. You need someone to keep you in line, and she still does today. And yep. You know, that's marriage. You need to listen sometimes, gentlemen. You need to listen.
Sure. Now, Simon, for a long time, you stayed completely out of the media spotlight. Really, until Osama bin Laden was killed. How did you feel when that happened?
Yeah, well, and the word is confused, because I believe that there's no place for killing someone on either side of the coin. There is no reason to take a human's life. I think, you know, we're very precious and amazing animals, us people. I struggle to see how someone can feel it's all right to snuff out someone's life. It's something I fail to understand, really. And I refuse to take part in it. I oppose the death penalty.
And I suppose, in a sense, taking a stand on that and having to think very deliberately about that has also led you to acknowledging that really, you know, the path of hatred doesn't go anywhere good, and you've been really deliberate about choosing to forgive.
Yeah, look, I mean, whatever side of the religious fence you sit on, you know, there are a lot of brands out there, there are a lot of religions out there, and I've had some lovely conversations with people who think the same way. I've sat down for hours with the brother of one of the another Australian victim who died in the Twin Towers, and he's a very devout Christian, but is also, you know, very adamant about not endorsing hatred towards Muslims, or because they're just people trying to get on with their lives, really. You know, they might do it differently to you or I, but they're not all bad. They're just people, you know. They're neighbours just like anyone else. And it was very comforting to hear someone as dedicated he is to his religion saying that live and let live. And,
yeah, absolutely.
And likewise, when I was in Washington, I met with a Muslim cleric over there who was also saying exactly the same thing. And it was really comforting to know that you don't have to be Christian to have Christian values. You know, I don't think they have to be exclusively owned by Christians. And I think the world's a better place if they're shared around. And that's why hatred gets you nowhere. And if you're dealing with something nasty in your life, you're trying to get over it, the last thing you want to do is put all your energy into hating someone you don't know, because you're never going to get on with life.
I mean, I think by far that's the thing that is the most powerful in your book, is that message of forgiveness and of racial and religious tolerance. But for you personally, where do you get the capacity to forgive?
It's a good question, where it comes from.
Where does it come from? Yeah.
Maybe it was bred into me, you know.
From your mum?
Yeah, I'd say so. From my mum and dad, I mean, they brought us up in a very strict, might not be quite the word, but I guess...
disciplined kind of house?
Well, they were a devout Catholic, you know, family, and, you know, they took us to church every day. And as young people do, they often reject the concept of going to church, you know, because it's not as exciting as going to kick a football.
sure.
But I took away, you know, from that upbringing quite a lot, and that is love your fellow man. And quite frankly, I like the world better that way.
Yeah. You know, yeah, absolutely.
And that's we're privileged to live in a country where that's more possible than anywhere. It makes me baffled that people choose not to live that way in a country like this. And I think it was bred into me. You know, we had neighbours. We grew up not too far from these studios with people around us. You know, we had Indian, Lebanese, South African, Chinese all around us, everyone getting along, everyone following a different playbook, but everyone being neighbours and you know, and looking out for each other. And who wants the opposite to that?
And how would you like your mum to be remembered, Simon?
Well, she was a strong woman. She was a funny woman. You know, you could just ask her, she'd tell you she was a funny woman. And I think I've got a lot of my sense of humour from her. She's she was compassionate, very compassionate. She brought up two boys on her own while still finding time to volunteer for the Australian Red Cross most weekends. And she taught me a lot about humanity. It's a shame there aren't more people around like her, and it's certainly a shame she's not around to start cracking the whip on me and her grandchildren, who she never got to meet.
In a sense, you have resurrected your family, haven't you?
Yeah, look, I mean, all families have strange dynamics and that sort of thing, and, you know, my brother and I are very different people, but we're family, and that's important to keep that, I guess, to keep that going.
Yeah,
you know, and
connection.
Yeah.
What she started, in a sense. It's
exactly.
Carrying on. Yeah.
Totally. Family has become so important. And to me, now that I've got two kids, you realise how important it is. And, you know, you always strive to do as good a job as you can. And I hope my kids grow up with some of those lessons that I learnt.
Yeah. Well, I think they've inherited a remarkable legacy from your mum. And I think she'd be very proud of this book.
Thank you, mate. Thank you.
Yeah, it's Simon Kennedy. He is the author of 9/11 and The Art of Happiness. And you can also see some personal belongings of his mum on display in the National Museum of Australia.